and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet David Sauner. After receiving an MFA from the University of Iowa, David Sauner worked for 25 years as an iron ore miner, furnace tender, and laborer. His previous books include John Henry's Partner Speaks. His poems have appeared in many journals, including Three Penny Review, The Iowa Review, Poetry Northwest, Prairie Schooner, North American Review, and Poetry Daily. Hi, David. How are you?
Fine, thanks, Lauren.
Well, welcome to Prosody.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Can you begin by reading us some poems?
I'd be glad to. The first one is about my mother, about the sacred right of a woman's choice. From my perspective as an adopted child, choice. It's a wonderful thing to have a mother you didn't come from. I can remember when I was four, the heavy varnish on the floor I was playing on in one of those apartments built all over Baltimore after the war. My mother holds me in the glitter of her black eyes, expressing humor easily, strength and care, and love with difficulty. She has my father there for backup. It's a conversation filled with produce words. We picked you out as if I were an avocado and they were squeezing my chubby knees, or a cantaloupe. My mother sniffs my belly button while the world looks on. We'll take this one, she announces, because he's ripe. Both of them are smoking, and the words parade in the smoke, dance in the air high overhead, meaningless as motes. For I had already adopted my mother when she was a girl about my age, playing on the marble steps in a neighborhood where poor Jews lived in row houses. My Orthodox grandmother had a painting of a handsome man, her husband, who disappeared when his bank failed. They never saw him again. As I stared at the painting, I understood my father would disappear also, in a way my mother never would. The words meant nothing to me, for my mother's eyes had already told me what I had to know. I was not the fruit of her body, but of something more important, her choice. I was the fruit of a woman's choice. Now, even in the age of political correctness, I still say the most important thing a father can teach is how to fight. And that's what this next poem is about. A Father's Lesson. This poem is also from my first book, John Henry's Partner Speaks. A Father's Lesson. A skinny man, he looks ferocious, dancing over the grease marks in our garage, holding his fists like rocks in front of his face. Keep your face down, my father says, as he scuffles and strikes at the air with sudden vengeance. Keep away from him until you see his nose. Then sock him hard. Never pull your punches. The next day, I use his advice on Harold, the schoolyard bully, who screamed, running away from PS 87. When my father was 15, he got a factory job in one of those tough Hungarian towns near Pittsburgh. A big guy pushed him down and rubbed his face on the floor. My father waited until the big guy lowered his head to the drinking fountain. Then he picked up a shovel and bashed him with everything he had in that skinny body, driving the nose into the steel fountain so that blood and water splashed over the wall. Don't fight fair, my father tells me. If someone wants to fight fair, you won't have to fight him. I think back to the bullies and officers who baited my father, witch hunted him, drove him out of his job to a nervous breakdown. They never came out in the open, and my father, looking half punch drunk from wine and gin, never knew what hit him. The nose has so many nerve endings, my father tells me. Even a brave man will cry when he's hit there, and bullies aren't brave. Years later, I have a clear shot at Harold's nose and drive my fist even harder now. That's for my father. Industry is where I spent a good deal of my time and most of my working life. And if you work in West Virginia, where I did for many years, you also spend a lot of time traveling, looking for work, including going as far away as the Bluegrass State. You were spilling your guts out, as usual, as we drove into the Bluegrass State from the West Virginia side, looking for work. We wanted to pick up on the rumors, so we stopped for some fast food, and they told us one steel mill was running, but the other one was down, and a lot of folks would have trouble this Christmas. I checked the one ads while you talked, and then we went back through the parking lot, hands in pockets, shoulders bumping, you talking, and the traffic fell on your voice like earth. I could see what you were saying, only too late. And then we left the Bluegrass State. Industry is often considered drab. I didn't find it to be. I found it a very colorful place with very colorful characters. Even the layoffs were colorful. This next poem is called The Hot Times. This one is from my book, Working Here. Both of these books are available from Amazon, naturally. I think everything's available from Amazon, right?
Probably.
Okay, The Hot Times. The first time I saw molten steel, it looked like a yellow lake. We were specters, haunting the steel, dissolving in its light, then pouring out. Carbon specks, discernible in heat after heat. On a long weekend in December, we went shopping downtown, and the streets were full of lights, some red, some green, some white as the steel I cast. When I went back to the hot end, I got the news the foundry was laying us off. They put 4x8 sheets over shop windows. Spring arrived like a trailer of scrap. The hot times were over.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet David Sallner, reading from his books, John Henry's Partner Speaks, and Working Here. There's a lot going on in your poetry, David, a lot of working class imagery, grounded in place. I'm curious how you weave those things together, the place and the working class imagery. How do you take what's ordinary and make it poetic?
Well, it really is poetic because it was created by human beings, and human beings work there. The drama that takes place is the human drama, very human drama, when people are laid off, when people come to work, when they have trouble getting to work because they're hungover. It's all very human. And the colors and sights in a giant mill or mine are spectacular. People who've never seen them are really missing out on something.
So who do you envision as the audience for this type of poetry?
Well, when I write, I imagine friends of mine who are very literate workers. Mm-hmm. And there are very literate workers, I know you know. and just a more general public. I think that poetry should speak to everyone. It has its own rules, its own internal dimensions, but it should speak to everyone, I think.
Mm-hmm. Are you motivated by giving these people in this industry and this people in this geographic location a voice? Does that motivate you?
Yes.
These people deserve this industry deserves a voice. I think that's what's great about poetry is that everything deserves a voice in a sense. And what do we choose to give a voice to?
Yes. I think now more than ever, people deserve a voice from all walks of life, and certainly everyone does. The thing is that poetry takes place in a dimension of culture that will hopefully be with us. Hopefully culture won't be destroyed, although, you know, you look at contemporary society and you also look back at history and you think that is a possibility. I don't think it's a very big possibility, and I think people will resist that. but you feel that what you're doing has a value in terms of where culture can be going. So, yeah, there are many reasons for writing. And the people that I think people in the future will enjoy looking back and saying, oh, so there were people like this, you know. So people did crazy things like this. Just like we look back and look at Chaucer's, people in Chaucer's time, and they say, oh, they really sat down by the cathedral there and told stories to each other, you know,
that's
when the plague was taking place.
Yeah, people really worked in the foundries and this type of industry. Can you read some more poems?
Oh, of course. I'd be glad to. I wish more people asked me to. Okay, northern Minnesota is the focus of a number of my poems. I started thinking more about my period in northern Minnesota when I was an iron ore miner during the layoffs that began in 2008. It just took me back to that time when so many thousands of people were laid off on the iron range. Well, in Pittsburgh, too, but I was on the iron range at the time. And so this poem is about that, and that's where I learned to be an industrial worker. And I even gave up poetry for a time while I was there. On the iron range, where I tossed my first book of poems. I tossed my first book of poems into a trash can outside a mine. It was a hot day. The book stirred up yellow jackets feasting on soda cans. So I hurried into the locker room, which we called a dry, because that's where our coveralls hung from a chain in the ceiling with the legs outstretched like the skins of large animals, still wet when we climbed back into them. I worked in the mine, patrolling a rotary kiln, the largest in the world, said the company. All night it rolled like a great whale in bearings the size of my house. My partner told stories about the old days when he drank at Tony's instead of going home to sleep, and then passed out in the gray mud under the filter floor. We laughed and talked as the machine splattered mud all over us. Later that winter, after the hunters had divided the deer into neat packages and the fishermen had begun putting wood stoves into their ice houses, and after the snowmobilers had begun cruising under bridges and into forbidden areas, I skied to the top of an old tailing stump where all I could see were spruce and tamarack rising from the stillness of an ocean frozen under feet of snow all the way to Lake Superior, a silent ocean in which I could no longer hear the crushers gyrating boulders of iron at the edge of a sleeping town. Then Christmas. U.S. Steel laid us off by the thousands, and I left the Iron Range, where I tossed my first book of poems. So, time to relax and get away from industry for a couple of minutes, and I want to read another poem from my book, Working Here. It's about a judge we love to hate, named Simon, and the name of the poem is American Idol, Idol spelled I-D-Y-L-L. We knew it was his job to be mean, but did he have to be that mean? The judge had led her on, saying, the thing about a voice like yours is that no matter what you sing, and pausing just long enough for her to hope, it sounds like crap. Her guitar sagged from her arm, and we knew even a judge has no right to be that mean. We started to boo. We booed the judges, the network, and the ads. We booed until her shoulders straightened and her hand slid down the throat of her guitar, and she opened with the chords of the only song we had to hear. And then she sang into the very darkness of our lives, Love Me Tender. And tender was more than a word. It was the way things ought to be. The last note died away. she bowed toward us, leveled her gaze at the judge, whose eyes tried to say, "I'm sorry." She looked at him and grinned. She just grinned. So I want to read some new poems. This first one is about a colorful character I worked with who when I worked just down the road near Clarksburg, West Virginia, at a graphite factory. And every shift we'd come out covered with graphite dust, which was very hard to wash off. And I'm not accustomed to quoting the Bible, but the poem begins with a quote from the Bible. "Prophet of furnaces and dust. I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry." It's from Ezekiel 37, if you didn't know already. I'm sure most of you already knew. "After Vietnam, he came home to fight with the dust, went wild with the injustice, waged war with everyone and lost. He cried and drank himself raving mad each night, but a revelation saved him of Jesus in a furnace room, drifting above the dust. Jesus and the meds a Clarksburg doctor gave him, mood adjusters, which could dissolve his burnt out eyes into a sheepish grin. An Old Testament fury crackled in his face when he guessed I was not only a Jew, but an atheist. Still, he treated me with the utmost kindness. He was Ezekiel. We were the captives of Babylon, laboring all midnight shift amid clouds of dried pitch, death itself, shouldering plates of cold steel, threading nuts large as a fist, clattering them tight with an impact, working so slowly, every move became a deliberation because, as he revealed, look what this company did to Bhopal. Don't bust your ass for it. I accepted his revelations, but not as Lord, and he accepted that. After so many layoffs, we were left to walk in the shadow of furnaces caked with snow, shattered ribs of concrete, crumbling walls of refractory, warped crane rails, buckets with iron jaws rusted shut, a shambles of dead pigeons, feathers packed with carbon, ancient temples half buried in deserts of desiccated greed, revelations of dust. I showered, couldn't wash off the dust. Then I walked away, leaving him in a valley of dry bones that would rise and live." I should say, as a footnote to that one, that the prophet was actually a person who was very helpful to me and protected my job on a number of occasions, like a number of people in industry who pull together and do things no matter what kind of disagreements and differences they have. Now, another new poem I wanted to read about seeing ourselves in history, because I think that gives a lot of richness to everything that we do, is the fact that we live in history, even when it buries us in snow, which it ends up doing more often than not. "Abandoned mine under snow." This is set also in northern Minnesota after the layoffs that hit there. "The first winter, I learned how the snow could whistle through forests of memory, of popple, of spruce, how the pit of the Rocklow mine looked under snow like a lake of lovely sorrow, unfathomable. When I got a job in the mines, I stamped the snow off my boots, ordered doubles of Christian, straight up. I can see myself, even now, stepping inside where the heat thawed my beard. I learned how to fight the long shifts, the bashed fingers, the orange-white flash of a torch in dark goggles. The should have, the shouldn't, all night. Years passed. After Christmas, after the layoffs, I climbed to the top of a dump, beautiful in the snow, iridescent, and gazed into the Rocklow mine, into the pit, where the bent miners once worried, once studied the walls, where the blind mules tramped through haulageways lost in time. Someone was working beside them, tiny and cold. He was thinking, how lovely the flakes, how quickly they drift, how deep this lake of sorrow, this shift after shift.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet David Sauner, reading from his books Working Here and John Henry's Partner Speaks. Now, earlier you mentioned sort of taking a break, giving up poetry for a time, as you called it. Can you talk about that journey? What made you decide to give it up, come back to it? Was it still always there as you were working?
Well, that's the thing, is that it still was there. And years later, when I was no longer in physical shape to work in iron ore mines and steel foundries and places like that, I could back off a little bit, not devote myself 100% to some of the things that I had been devoting myself to. I found I could still write, and that was great. You know, it was just terrific to be able to go back to writing. And really, I think that type of experience gave me something to write about. One reason that I had stopped writing was because I didn't really have much to write about, I think. And I came back to it with a great deal to write about.
So you feel as sort of your process is to draw on the lived experience as opposed to like the imagined experience as a writer?
Yeah, I write imaginatively, like just straight out of my head sometimes, but I tend to write more from my life experience. One influence on me was reading the work of Philip Levine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure many of your listeners have read some of his work, and a number of his books, like What Work Is, are just really beautiful books about experiences with people and places and his working experiences were years removed, many, many years removed from when he was writing, and yet it was still vivid in his imagination, and it gave his work a real content, I think, that a lot of other poetry doesn't have. But everyone has experiences,
right?
But not everyone feels they can draw on them, I guess.
I enjoy the way that your poems sort of focus on a moment a lot of times, slow down and focus on a moment of lived experience. Do you think about that later? Pick moments when you're writing poems? Do you think about moments that you want to write about? Or as you're living, you're like, oh, this would make a great poem.
That's a great question. But really, no, it's later, many years later. And there is a funny thing. Now, the circumstances are all true in maybe I shouldn't say they're all true, but they're mostly true in what I write. But people think that because you're using I in a poem, that everything in that poem is strictly true and absolutely happened.
Mm-hmm.
And no, it didn't.
Right. Well, you know.
Some of it is imagined.
Right. And you know, as you said, like sometimes it's years later that you draw on these moments. So.
Yeah.
Years later, we're going to have to fill in the gaps. I mean,
we can't
remember accurately everything. That would be amazing if we could. We have time to read a few more?
Yes. Actually, I'd be glad to read a poem about, this is on a more literary issue. John Clare was a poet of the early 18 and mid 1800s. He was a mad poet. But today, when we look back at him and what he stood for in his life, or tried to. Most of his life was, a good bit of his life was spent in asylums or escaping from asylums, but he doesn't seem so mad. In fact, he seems quite heroic today when you think of the type of society he lived in. Just as many of us who brave all kinds of things in the society we live in are heroic, even though most other society at large doesn't view us as heroic. Anyway, this is John Clare Escapes the Asylum, and it's about his escape from an asylum and finding refuge in a camp of Roma who are termed gypsies. Maybe not the best term we could use, but it was the term used at the time. John Clare Escapes the Asylum. John slips the greasy shirted brute who reeks of puke from those he's torn, and dodges chokehold, large, cold bang of knuckle bruise on socket bone, runs through yellow of hearthlight, dark hallway, runs to the blue glass, evening glow, stoops to find a hand-sized key and throws the bolt and sees the sky, ash-colored in a great round shell of night, the first in those 4 years, pauses to see the native air flow softly through the witch elm tops, now laughs at lime trees he runs by, and has the thought that those thick trunks have not been ripped by a rich man's plow, dances through hazel scratch and laughs at crunch of cob under his feet, as shadows wash his face with tartness of crabapple, of berry breath, the pleasant rot of spring-fed air, then sniffs a trace of charcoal sweetness, smoking on the chilly night, hears gossip, low-voiced, lyrical, so near to ear, and strides into the clearing, bold and shy, into the place where fires hiss gold on gypsy faces, where eyes are shining, where all around the sugar of escape, to those that know so well the hate on hate of the asylum that he fled, he did. And song and honey wine pick up, the heels of all the families there, a quick-limbed romp that dazzles him. Their hands wake up in pools of dew and shape the day from day-long love and form a slow horse caravan to ease John's tale, to pillow his shrewd death. Okay, I'd like to read a short poem for my wife. There are many things that to say about Barbara. One of the least of them is that we spend many happy hours together watching Jeopardy on TV. Final Jeopardy. More than anything, you love to put up your tired feet and watch Jeopardy in the evening with Lily and the dog and the darkness resting outside on the boards of the deck, and a pointed or wounded remark to which you answer, "What is a barb?" by clicking a ballpoint pen for your buzzer, as the other contestants are stumped, the librarian and the software specialist from the West Coast, where you never lived, and the darkness moves in the trees beyond the deck, warning you not to bet at all, save something, the leaves sigh for the long ride home, as you stare back through the bus window, and people in Texas watch you go by and whisper words that will follow you forever. Why didn't you know? Why didn't you answer to a dance in triple time and a jacket? What is bolero?
The poetry of David Sounder. Thank you so much for being here, David.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Lauren. I want to thank the radio station and everyone else.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody, 90.5 FM.